From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the complex, sometimes contradictory relationship between America and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are our long-term allies, but 15 of the 19 suicide hijackers were Saudis. Osama bin Laden grew up in Saudi Arabia. We'll talk with Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East regional editor. In the current edition, he writes about the Saudi-U.S. relationship, a tale of money, oil, personal ties, and access. Also, novelist and screenwriter Richard Price reads an excerpt of his New York Times Magazine article about how life has changed in New York since September 11th. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Bush today signed an executive order that would allow non-citizens accused of terrorism or terrorism-related charges to be tried in special military courts. The executive order directs Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to set up the tribunals. White House counsel Al Gonzalez told the Reuters news agency the president would be the one to decide whether an individual is in fact a member of a terrorist organization and subject to the special courts. The National Transportation Safety Board has found more clues about the possible cause of the fatal crash of American Airlines Flight 587. Both the plane's flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder have been recovered. NPR's Marianne Akers says officials have begun analyzing the sounds on the voice recorder.
On the cockpit voice recorder, investigators say they can hear rattling noises aboard the aircraft, and they hear the American Airlines pilots talking about the wake vortex they've just encountered from another jetliner in front of them. A wake is like a horizontal tornado that moves through the sky behind an airplane, and American Airlines Flight 587 apparently ran into a JAL flight's wake. NTSB member George Black says the first sound heard on the cockpit recorder is an airframe rattling noise. Then the pilots mentioning the wake vortex, and then a second airframe rattle. Right after that, Black says the co-pilot calls for maximum power, and then he says there are several comments about loss of control. Marianne Akers, NPR News, New York.
In Afghanistan, now that the Northern Alliance appears to have captured the Afghan capital of Kabul, there is concern about what happens next. The BBC's Kate Clark reports from Kabul.
This is a relatively liberal city, and the Taliban, their rules were always an alien imposition, a harsh rule on this city. So there's certainly relief, but a whole lot of anxiety. And that really came to the fore this morning when there was looting, there were revenge attacks, there were seven foreign militants, dead bodies in a ditch when I arrived in Kabul this morning. They had money in their mouths, cassette tape wrapped around their throats. It's a way of dishonouring the dead here. And the cassette tapes, of course, the Taliban banned. The capacity for chaos is here in this city. There are police here now, but people are very worried that there's no political agreement. And the Northern Alliance is just one group. Tonight, I've spoken to people who said that one of the other groups, Hizbi Wahadat, have set up posts in the west of the city.
The BBC's Kate Clark in Kabul. Investigators say eight samples taken from a State Department mail facility in Northern Virginia have tested positive for anthrax. The eight are among 55 samples tested at the site. A government anthrax expert says it is a strong indication that there is a tainted letter in the State Department system that remains to be found. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 196 points to close at 97.49. The Nasdaq was up 52. This is NPR News. A fraternity at Auburn University has been disbanded after officials say photos of racially offensive Halloween costumes surfaced on the Internet. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
The National Office of Beta Theta Pi Fraternity closed its Auburn chapter indefinitely after members were photographed in blackface, wearing Afro wigs and jerseys of one of Auburn's historically black fraternities. The East Alabama school has withdrawn university sponsorship of the group. Interim President William Walker said Auburn will show little tolerance when a fraternity abuses its privileges. Officials are also deciding how to punish another all-white fraternity, Delta Sigma Phi, because of photos that show members staging a mock lynching with one fraternity brother dressed as a Ku Klux Klansman holding a noose around the neck of a brother in blackface. Meanwhile, the University of Mississippi has suspended Alpha Tau Omega fraternity for a year after photos from a Halloween party there show one member dressed as a police officer holding a gun on another in blackface. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops today chose a man considered to be a powerful orator and outspoken critic of racism as its new president. Bishop Wilton Gregory is the first black man elected to the post. Gregory says he will continue to speak out about racism as a violation of Christ's teaching and an evil that Catholics must work to end. Preliminary results from today's recount in the Atlanta mayoral race show Shirley Franklin has avoided a runoff again. The Fulton County Elections Board says Franklin actually picked up 9 votes in today's recount. She finished with 188 votes more than needed to stave off a runoff with City Council President Rob Pitts. 5,000 acres continue to burn in eastern Tennessee in what officials are calling the worst fire outbreak in a decade. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Osama bin Laden grew up in Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 September 11th suicide hijackers were Saudi dissidents. But the Saudi royal family has been America's most reliable long-term ally in the Arab world. We're going to take a look at the complicated relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and examine some of the reasons why the royal family is facing opposition from within. My guest Christopher Dickey co-wrote an article in the current issue of Newsweek called The Saudi Game, which is subtitled A Tale of Money, Oil, Personal Ties, and Access. Dickey has been Newsweek's Middle East regional editor since 1993 and is also the Paris bureau chief. His books include a memoir about his father, the late writer James Dickey. This morning, I asked Christopher Dickey about the paradox of Saudi Arabia being our ally, but also the home of terrorists who have attacked us.
Well, I think the feelings are extremely mixed in Saudi Arabia. Americans have been there since the 1930s. The United States was instrumental, or Americans were instrumental, in the Saudis discovering and developing the enormous oil wealth that they have. And certainly people in the House of Saud, the ruling family, understand that extremely well. But there are a lot of Saudis who have not benefited as much as the House of Saud from that wealth, and who have also had, I wouldn't say the benefit of an education inside Saudi Arabia, but have been educated inside Saudi Arabia to norms that are, well, I think we describe them as fundamentalist. And there is a lot of resentment by them against the United States and what they see as a very misguided foreign policy in the United States, but also what they see as a kind of a rampant consumerism. They believe that all that the United States really represents is the kinds of shopping malls that have been built all over Saudi Arabia and the kind of consumerism that they see constantly on American satellite television.
How much is the Saudi government cooperating with the U.S. investigation into terrorism?
It's cooperating very quietly but very extensively as far as we can tell. When we started working on the piece for Newsweek, what we believed was the case is that the Saudis had been stonewalling on a lot of the investigation, as they were alleged to have done with the Khobar bombing in 1996. But the more we looked at it, the more we talked to American officials, including very senior people in the U.S. side of the investigation, the more we were convinced that, in fact, the Saudis have cooperated very extensively.
But you say very quietly. Is that so as to not alienate the anti-American constituency within the country?
Well, the great bind, the great paradox that the Saudis face is that they are great friends of the United States, but if they are seen to be great friends of the United States, in some ways it delegitimizes them in the eyes of their own people and of the rest of the Arab world. So they prefer to be extremely discreet, and there are even cases where the United States government, presidents, and politicians have blamed the Saudis for one or another failing that was absolutely not true, and the Saudis have just stayed silent rather than say, no, but you see, we really have been very helpful. They'd rather just keep it quiet.
Now, the United States needs Saudi Arabia as a military base and for the oil. How much oil do we get from Saudi Arabia?
Well, we don't get that much oil from Saudi Arabia. I forget the precise numbers. It's certainly less than 10%. But that's not really the point. One of the reasons I don't pay attention to the volume of oil is that the question is not whether the U.S. can live without Saudi oil being imported to the United States. The question is, can we live without the Saudis controlling, effectively, the world price of oil? And that we cannot do. The thing to remember is that the Saudis are the only country, Saudi Arabia is the only country that is not producing oil to the limit of its capacity. Saudi Arabia can increase and decrease the amount of oil it puts on the world market by millions of barrels a day. And that gives them the power, basically, to decide, quite independently of OPEC or any other organization, what the world price of oil will be. And that is where they have worked to their own benefit, but also to the benefit of the United States for more than 25 years. And that's why we have a huge crisis in the Middle East right now, and oil prices are lower at the gas pump than they have been for a long time.
So the Saudis keep the price down?
They absolutely do. They keep it stable is the most important thing. Saudi Arabia has about $600 billion invested outside Saudi Arabia, and most of that is in the United States. They have every interest in seeing the United States maintain a stable and prosperous economy, and they work toward that end. And that's been the understanding now for more than two decades.
And what's in it for the Saudis to maintain a strong alliance with the United States?
Well, their security is guaranteed by the United States. Washington sent people immediately when Kuwait was invaded because everybody was concerned about Kuwait, but everybody was even more concerned that Saddam Hussein would either occupy or simply intimidate Saudi Arabia to the extent that he would have the power to dictate world oil prices. So the Saudis can rely on Washington to guarantee their security. But I think that that can be overstated. If the presence of American troops on Saudi soil continues to damage the credibility of the Saudis in the eyes of other Muslims, and that's very possible, then I think the Saudis would want to rethink whether that basing agreement really makes much sense. And I think the United States would have to look at that and say, does it really pay off to have those planes there? Most of the reason that the United States is there is because there are still planes flying Operation Southern Watch over southern Iraq. It's not because they're there actively defending the Saudis.
The leader of Saudi Arabia is different now than he was during the Gulf War. King Fahd, who was leading the country during the Gulf War, had a stroke in 1995, and he's too sick to rule. So Crown Prince Abdullah is the person with the real power now. What are some of the political differences and leadership differences between Prince Abdullah and King Fahd?
Well, in Saudi Arabia, all politics are family politics. And one of the essential things to know about King Fahd is that he is one of seven extremely powerful brothers who are all the sons of the same mother. All the kings of Saudi Arabia after the founder, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, have been sons of Abdulaziz ibn Saud. Every one of them has been a brother or a half-brother of his predecessor. And in the case of King Fahd, his brothers include the present defense minister, the present interior minister, and the present governor of Riyadh, among others. So it's an incredibly powerful clique, but the crown prince, Abdullah, does not belong to that group of brothers. He has no full brothers, and he has different alliances within the family. And it's also important to remember that King Fahd and his brothers have a long, long history of, shall we say, knowing the West. Traveling in the West, knowing people in the West, experiencing the pleasures of the West in ways that everybody in Saudi Arabia knows about. And Abdullah has a different kind of reputation. He is seen as someone who has been very much more involved with and occupied by the concerns of the Arab and the Muslim world. not a man to be spending a lot of time in the United States or Europe, rather more austere than King Fahd and his brothers. So there is an automatic difference in style, and it's believed that as the Crown Prince continues to put his stamp on the government, there will also be some significant changes in personnel. One of those was the removal, rather precipitously, of the intelligence chief, Turki Alfaisal, just the week before the September 11th events.
Now, one person who remains the same in the power structure is the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar. And just describe him. You describe him very well in your article on Newsweek.
What a guy. Bandar is, I think, one of the greatest diplomats of his generation, probably. He has been the key go-between between Washington and Saudi Arabia, between presidents and the kings, for more than 20 years. He's been ambassador almost 20 years, but there were about 8 years before that where he was an active player on the ground in Washington with different titles. He is the nemesis, in some cases, of the Israeli lobby, because the famous cases that he oversaw were the acquisition of AWACS and sophisticated fighter aircraft for Saudi Arabia over the objections of Israel. And he has gone on to be a great close personal friend of the Bushes, with whom, of course, he spent a lot of time during the Gulf War. It's said that they call him Bandar Bush, and he will do things like cook pasta dinner for one of Barbara Bush's birthdays. And when Dorothy Bush was left alone in the White House in 1990 during Thanksgiving, Bandar's wife invited her out to a country place to spend Thanksgiving with her. It's that kind of relationship at the very highest levels that he exploits on a daily basis to try and reduce misunderstandings and enhance the partnership between the House of Saud and the Presidents of the United States.
You also credit Prince Bandar with helping Oliver North get funding for the Contras and helping to persuade King Fahd to allow the U.S. to use Saudi Arabia as a launching pad for troops during the Gulf War.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Bandar is a great facilitator, and he wants Washington to understand that the Saudis, the royal family, are great facilitators. He, by the way, is just a note on family politics. He is the son of the defense minister, and therefore the full nephew, as it were, of the king, King Fahd. He coughed up $20 million for the Contras just because Ollie North asked him. And he thought, well, great, we don't want the U.S. backing out of its commitment to the Contras. It would look bad overseas. It would look bad for its commitments elsewhere, including in Saudi. He does a lot of advance work for U.S. diplomats and for U.S. diplomacy. There are times when, for instance, the Secretary of State will be traveling in the Middle East, and if you trace Bandar's trajectory, you'll see that his itinerary was exactly the same, only a day or so in advance of the Secretary of State. So he's a real player.
So Prince Bandar is really chummy with American politicians and America's leadership. Is he as close to Crown Prince Abdullah as he was to King Fahd?
Well, he's not as closely related to Crown Prince Abdullah as he was to King Fahd, is to King Fahd. And in fact, when Crown Prince Abdullah succeeds to the throne, then Sultan, who is Bandar's father, will become the new crown prince. At least that's what everybody expects. So there's a lot of competition there, and it's not clear whether Abdullah is really comfortable with Bandar's style. All this biculturalism, all this ability to go, for instance, go to a Dallas Cowboys football game and arrange to break his Ramadan fast in the middle of it with a special room set aside, that gives you an idea how bicultural he can be. All of that is very appealing to Americans and to his American friends and people in the oil industry, but it's not clear that it's all that appealing to the relatively more austere Crown Prince Abdullah.
My guest is Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East regional editor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Dickey. He's the Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor of Newsweek magazine, and this week he writes about Saudi Arabia. Let's talk about how the royal family is perceived by the people of Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of talk about corruption within the royal family. What kind of corruption?
Flamboyant corruption. Corruption that is almost oblivious to itself because the Saudi government or the Saudi regime, the Saudi royal family, gets so much money from so many sources, from oil, from arms deals, from airplane deals, from construction contracts, that it is not only beyond the dreams of avarice, it's almost beyond imagining. And to some extent, the Saudis were always willing and able to share that kind of wealth with the general population. But as the population has grown and the cost of certain adventures like the Gulf War have come home to roost, the government, as a government, has been much less generous with the Saudi people. And so there are a lot of Saudis who feel that they're being cut out of the action and feel that the House of Saud, the royal princes, still live better than royalty, while the people themselves have had to lower their expectations and are much less pampered than they used to be, and in some cases are poor. There are Saudi dissidents who will tell you that there are between 1 and 2 million Saudis who are living below the poverty line. I don't think there are any real statistics to back that up, but there are certainly many Saudis that you would define as poor.
The Saudi royal family is part of the Wahhabi sect of Islam, which is a very strict sect. Yet many members of the family, like Prince Bandar, are very westernized and party a lot. Are there members of the Saudi family who are seen by Muslims as being very hypocritical?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the charge that that is brought against the Saudi ruling family all the time is that it is a family of hypocrites. The term they use in Arabic is munafakin, and that is an extremely pejorative charge in Islam. And you just hear it used all the time by dissidents and opponents of the regime. That is exactly the kind of charge that bin Laden and his supporters in Saudi Arabia were constantly bringing against the House of Saud before bin Laden switched his target to the United States. How true is it? Are there Saudis in influential positions and Saudi princes who drink alcohol, who indulge themselves with prostitutes? Yeah, absolutely. It's just undeniable. And sometimes it's very hard for them to maintain the image of austere religiosity that is cultivated by people who subscribe to the teachings of the Wahhabis. But whether that is enough to alienate them from their own people and usher in a new regime, usher in their downfall and a new regime, well, I'm not sure that that's the case, because ultimately people are going to look at the government in Saudi Arabia and they're going to say, this may be bad, this may be corrupt, but can we really cleanse this regime? Can we really change it and wind up with something that is different from the Taliban? And contrary to what you think, I don't think there's a lot of support in Saudi Arabia for what you might call the Talibanization of Saudi Arabia.
What has the royal family's relationship been over the years with the Wahhabi clerics?
Well, the relationship has been complicated because the royal family, although its relationship with the Wahhabi clerics goes back hundreds of years, the founder of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, was a very practical man and a real political animal. There's a well-known anecdote, for instance, when St. John Philby, who was the British emissary to Abdulaziz, was sitting around during Ramadan once talking to him, and it was a summertime Ramadan and very hot, and the fasting was really arduous. And he asked the question, what would you do if you had to fast at the North Pole, where the sun never sets, because you have to fast from sun up to sundown? What would you do? And the king was a little bit surprised to hear that the sun never set at the North Pole, but then he thought about it, and he said, Well, we would just declare 12 hours to be day and 12 hours to be night, and we'd get on with our business. And that is the attitude of the House of Saud and the leaders of the House of Saud. But the clerics have never really accepted that. So you had anomalies as recently as within the last 20 years. You had the leader of the Saudi clerics still declaring that the earth was flat and that the Quran told him that. And you had just last year a fatwa issued against Pokemon cards. These are steps that make the clerics seem wildly out of touch with reality, and often they are. But the Saudis the Saudi government doesn't want to push the issue too far, because it feels, again, it not only has to keep the sort of deeply zealous part of the population on its side, it always has to try and shore up its religious legitimacy. Ultimately, religion is more important than realpolitik, or religion is realpolitik for the House of Saud.
And that's in part because the House of Saud are the protectors of the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia.
That is it. That's the beginning and the end of the game. They are not there because they were democratically elected, and they are not even there because they are incredibly rich. The beginning and the end is that they are there, and their legitimacy depends on their ability to assure the protection of and access to for Muslims, for a billion Muslims around the world, access to the holy cities of Mecca and Medina.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East regional editor and Paris bureau chief. He writes about Saudi Arabia in the current issue. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Elektra Entertainment, whose releases include Natalie Merchant's new album, Motherland. Natalie-Merchant.com or AOL keyword Natalie Merchant. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how bin Laden hurt the Palestinian cause. We continue our conversation with Christopher Dickey of Newsweek. Also, novelist and screenwriter Richard Price on the advice he's been giving his younger daughter since September 11th about getting around Manhattan where they live.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief. In the current issue, Dickey writes about the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney have worked in the oil business. Do their oil connections connect them in a special way to Saudi Arabia and the royal family?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know that there's a necessarily a dollars and cents connection, or at least not a direct one, but oil men built Saudi Arabia. And the rapport that exists between the House of Saud and the great oil companies that used to be represented in Aramco is enormous. Texans and Saudis are famously compatible.
Now, do you think that this might be a kind of subjective question, but do you think that the oil interests and America's larger political interests are ever at odds?
Well, if you have an idealized notion of American interests overseas, if you think that the United States should be fostering democracy and looking to the greater good of the masses in various countries around the world, all of which would be a laudable policy, then, yeah, there's absolutely a conflict. But the United States' history in the Middle East is absolutely dominated by two issues: what's good for oil and what's good for Israel. And neither of those issues is particularly popular with the great masses of Arabs and Muslims. So, you know, where are the interests of the United States served? If we want to continue driving very large cars, very long distances, with very cheap gas, then our first priority is going to be our alliance with the House of Saud. If we want to spread democracy and pluralism, then we'd have to look askance at the way Saudi Arabia is run. But the Saudis, they know this very well, and they will tell you off the record or in background, they'll look you right in the eye and they'll say, do not wish for democracy in the Arab world, much less in Saudi Arabia, because if you have democracy, every country in the Arab world will be against you. And basically, American policy has been conducted on that basis. And that's why we are so supportive of a dictator like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, or kings like King Hussein and his son King Abdullah in Jordan, and the House of Saud.
In other words, democracies would have more of an Islamist bent and be anti-American?
Well, they would certainly have more of an Islamist bent initially. Every time that the system has been really opened up to elections in almost any of these countries, the result has been the rise of Islamist parties. The most obvious case was Algeria in the early 90s, where the electoral system was opened up. There was supposed to be this great reform, and the result was an overwhelming victory for the Islamists, and followed immediately by a military coup and a civil war. So one has to go gently on the question of pluralism. One of the sort of depressing things about developments over the last couple of decades is the element that's disappeared is the secular democratic element in Arab society, particularly. You just don't hear the voices of humanists, of secularists saying, let's have real democracy, partly because they've been crushed by the regimes, but also because they are very much afraid of the mosques, and that if they start pushing for democracy, it will only be exploited by Islamists who really don't have much faith in an actual democratic system.
My guest is Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Dickey is my guest. He's the Paris Bureau Chief for Newsweek and the Middle East Regional Editor. Osama bin Laden has adopted the Palestinian cause as one of his causes. How long has the Palestinian cause been something that he has endorsed in a public way?
Beyond very cursory lip service, this is an extremely recent development. In fact, if you know the history of Osama, you see that he's been directly detrimental to the Palestinian cause in many, many ways for a very, very long time, including the cause of those people who are militant, violent opponents of Israel. The Arab Afghans, I think everybody understands now, has at least a cursory idea that Osama bin Laden was involved with the so-called Arab Afghans, the people who went to fight the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Well, the guy who organized all that was a man named Abdullah Azzam, who was a Palestinian from Hebron. And when the war was winding down against the Soviets, he wanted to take his Arab Afghans back to the occupied territories and fight the Israelis on the ground there. Osama bin Laden was adamantly opposed to that. In fact, he organized his followers in a completely different way and said, no, let's fight the regimes in Egypt. Let's fight the regimes in Algeria. Let's fight anywhere except Palestine. And then over the years, in the 1990s, he never raised the issue of Palestine as a major issue. He talked about Iraq a lot. He talked about American troops on Saudi soil. He might pay very quick lip service to the issue of Palestine, but it was nothing that he actively pursued. That's one of the reasons that when he came out with these pronouncements, the Palestinians, the Palestinian leadership, was absolutely furious. He had done nothing for them. Nothing in terms of moral support, nothing in terms of money, nothing in terms of military or violent support. And all of a sudden, he commits the greatest atrocity in the history of terrorism, and he embraces their cause. So they were extremely upset. And then to add to all that, what the Palestinians knew and the public didn't know is that Bandar and the Saudis had been working extremely closely with the Bush administration in late August and early September to push through what was going to be the most progressive position on Palestinian statehood and a shared Jerusalem that the United States government had ever taken. And when September 11th happened, all that came to a grinding halt.
What was the message that the Saudi royal family delivered to the Bush administration in August?
Well, I think the message was, what had happened was that the Bush administration kept saying, we're not going to get involved on the ground. We're not going to get ourselves stuck in the Middle East peace process the way the Clinton people did. And every time they would reiterate that, at least in the perception of Crown Prince Abdullah, the Eric Sharon, the Prime Minister Sharon in Israel, would up the ante. He would put more pressure on Arafat, more military pressure in the territories. Finally, at one point in August, Abdullah sort of looked at that situation and said, look, precisely because we are your closest friends in the Arab world and are so closely identified with Washington, if you don't do something to make this situation better, if you don't take the initiative and get involved and effectively rein in Sharon, we are going to be in an untenable position, and we are going to have to reconsider the basis of our relationship. Now, I don't think, we've checked this out as much as we could, I don't think there were any explicit threats, but the Bush administration knows what that means. It means that the Saudis might start rethinking their incredible support for stable and low oil prices, and they might start rethinking the basing of U.S. troops on Saudi soil. And that's none of that is something that the Bush administration wants to see rethought anytime soon. So that galvanized the State Department and galvanized the White House. And Bush sent back a very, what the Saudis regarded as a very promising letter in which he talked about Palestinian statehood, Jerusalem as a city for all religions, and staked out a lot of positions that are actually official U.S. policy, but not U.S. politics. And for instance, U.S. is officially opposed to all the settlements in the West Bank and in Gaza, but you wouldn't know that from the way the United States conducts its policy. So there was this sort of sense that there was a big breakthrough coming, and the timing for it was supposed to be in late September at the UN General Assembly. And according to the Saudis, they had spent that week of September 3rd nailing down the details, and everything was pretty much in place by September 10th. There was a lot of optimism in the air. And then the next day, of course, was September 11th.
So in that sense, bin Laden blew it for the people who he is officially endorsing, the Palestinians.
Totally, totally, totally. This is why the Palestinian leadership hates him so much. He totally blew it. He destroyed the chances of getting the Bush administration on board in from an Arab point of view, an extremely positive way. And he's never done anything to support the armed struggle either.
So,
and he's implicated the leadership, he's implicated the Palestinians in the worst terrorist atrocity in history.
What are you looking for in the near future in Saudi Arabia? What do you have your eyes on? What signs are you looking for?
Well, I think the big question there is the extent to which bin Laden and his followers and other dissidents will be able to turn popular emotions about the war in Afghanistan, the situation in Israel and Palestine, whether they will be able to turn that directly against the Saudi government and the House of Saud. And there are several occasions coming up when that potential exists. We're about to enter Ramadan. That has been overstated as a question of fighting during Ramadan, not fighting during Ramadan. But there are other problems that come with that. One is that it is a time of minor but very large pilgrimages to Mecca and Medina, called the Umrah. It's a holier time to make that pilgrimage. And so lots of people, often more than a million people, go to Mecca at the end of Ramadan, which will be in about a little over a month from now. And how do you manage those people with emotions running the way they are running in the Arab world and the Muslim world? How do you decide who you let in and who you don't let in? Do you have a massive police and military presence everywhere that people turn in Mecca? Does that in itself provoke confrontations? And then a couple of months later, after the end of Ramadan, you have the Hajj, where you have millions and millions of people going to Mecca and Medina to make the pilgrimage that they are obligated by their God to make at once in their lifetime. It's the holiest thing that they can do. And it has also been the occasion in the past of potentially disastrous violence. In 1979, radical fundamentalists took over, Saudi fundamentalists took over the Grand Mosque and occupied the building for a long time. And in 1987, there were clashes between Iranians, followers of Khomeini, and the Saudis that cost hundreds of lives and greatly increased tensions and violence in the Middle East. So I think we have to worry about these pilgrimages that are coming up, and I think the Saudis are very concerned.
Christopher Dickey, thank you so much, and I wish you safe travels.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief. Richard Price is one of the writers who described life in New York after September 11th in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We invited him to read an excerpt and talk with us. Price is the author of such novels as Freedom Land, Clockers, and The Wanderers. He wrote the screenplays for Sea of Love and The Color of Money and co-wrote last year's movie Shaft. Price, his wife, and their two daughters live in Manhattan. This reading recounts a conversation he had in October with his younger daughter, who's 14 and a half.
"Dad, can I tell you something?" his daughter said. "You promise not to get mad at me?" "Not really." "I dropped my cell phone in the toilet," she winced. "It's dead." "Don't worry about it," he said. "Take mine." "Seriously?" Then, with as much guilt as relief, she added, "What are you going to use?" "Not your problem. It's just, you know, with everything going on these days, it makes me breathe easier to know I can reach you no matter what. The kid's face went taut, not what he intended. Look, he said, touching her arm, don't get me wrong. Right now in this city, you need to keep your eyes open. You know, use common sense or whatever. But it's also very important that you live your life as normally as you can. That one opened up her floodgates. What if they bomb us, she said. Who bomb us? Nobody's going to bomb us. I don't even know who they are. What if they hijack another plane, she said. Look, here's the deal. You go to school, you work hard, no goofing off. You do your homework, you study for your tests. You go to your soccer practices. Game time rolls around, not too many headers. Come the weekends, you hang with your friends. Saturday morning, Sunday morning, you have a contest with your sister, see who can sleep the latest, okay? You live your life, okay? Okay, she said, her face lightening, a light peck and a dash for the door. Where are you going? He called out. I'm going to hang out with Cole. Hey, do me a favor, stopping her with one foot in the street. Don't go into any big stores tonight, okay? What? A little stutter in her step. Why? Just, he faltered, humor me. It's nothing. Okay, she said. And stay out of Washington Square. What's wrong with Washington Square? Well, I never liked you hanging out at Washington Square. What's wrong with Washington Square, she said. Absolutely, probably nothing. I'm just not too crazy about crowds right now, okay? Okay, okay, the tightness coming back into her face. But what could you do? And oh, he winced preemptively, the subway? You never heard of the subway. It doesn't exist for you, okay? He then added, sorry. By the time the kid hit the street, she looked as if someone had strapped a boulder onto her back, her father wondering if it was more dangerous for her inside the house than out.
Yeah, I really like that a lot. And it made me think about how, you know, how difficult it is to try to protect your kids without scaring the heck out of them by your attempt to be protective because they know something's wrong.
Well, you know, the line in here, once I saw it in print, that is, has been driving me insane is use common sense. Like, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it mean for a kid or an adult or anybody walking down the street? If you see a Taliban guy with a Kalashnikov hanging out in front of Barnes & Nobles, don't go up and talk to him. I mean, what does that mean? Use common sense. I mean, but that's what you wind up saying because you don't know what else to say.
What kind of puts you in the position that a lot of us feel the president has put us in? You know, when the president says, well, there's an alert, but go about your regular business.
Yeah, I don't get that one. I mean, I'm sure there's a reason that they're doing that way, but it eludes me for one. You know, I think it eludes everybody. I don't know what the point is.
But don't you kind of feel that way as a parent almost, that you're saying, well, go about your business, but use common sense, but don't do things that you otherwise ordinarily would do?
Well, it's the general helplessness. Plus, you know, kids, you know, you might have kids that are very alive to the information that's going around. And, you know, you might have kids that are basically kids, and it's not like it doesn't register, but, it's not like this adrenaline starburst that goes off in their head and stomach. But the anxiety is there all the time. It's like, you know, being in a house with divorcing parents or something. I mean, just because you're quiet in front of the kids, that doesn't mean the tension is not there. That doesn't mean the kids aren't feeling it. And just because you're not, you know, doing drills where everybody's trying to put on their gas mask and inject each other with, you know, some Cipro drug, that doesn't mean that the kids don't pick up what's in the air, you know, some more pronounced than others. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Do you feel any different about living in and raising children in Manhattan now than you did before September 11th?
I do. I mean, in some ways, you know, you kind of feel like a sitting duck. On the other hand, I feel like, well, what's the alternative? I'm not gonna throw everything in a covered wagon and move to Wichita. Forget it. You know, this is where we live. This is who we are. You know, and you know, it's almost a cliche because everybody's saying it now. This whole thing about you live your life, go out, you know, go about your life, but it's true because the alternative is, I mean, there is no alternative.
My guest is novelist and screenwriter Richard Price. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is novelist and screenwriter Richard Price, author of the novels Freedomland, Clockers, and The Wanderers. He lives in Manhattan, and many of his books and movies are set there. Have you been writing since the 11th?
You know, I've heard other writers and artists and sort of, you know, people that sort of have to go inside their own heads to make what they make talk about this, and I feel the same way. Your first reaction is everything feels, what you're doing is so trivial and so inconsequential that, you don't want to kill one more tree to publish one more page of this stuff. Yet, after a while, the trivial stuff is so important because the trivial stuff is the stuff of life. It's the stuff of life that we valued before September 11th, and we cannot stop valuing it because something happened. You know, and so it's very important to get back to what you were doing. For me, you know, I'm finishing a novel, and I had an ironic situation because the main character lives in a place like Jersey City and has a terrace where he's looking out on the New York skyline the whole damn book. And, you know, and it's now, what do you acknowledge that? Do you integrate it? Is it exploitative now? It's a little bit, you know, if you write, when I wrote Ladies Man in 1979, it was very, a large part of it was, you know, about, you know, gay male sexuality. And it was pre-AIDS. And in the midst of writing, AIDS came to the forefront. What do you do? I mean, do you acknowledge your writing in the moment, or do you place this in B.C. as opposed to A.D.?
So what are you doing with the new novel that you're finishing up?
I'm integrating it because I can't ignore it. I can't stand the novel on its head, but I just can't ignore it, and the struggle is to find the balance.
Do you resent having to go back and rewrite so much of it?
No, I don't. I mean, because characters are allegedly human beings, and human beings respond like I responded to that. I'm different than I was before September 11th, and these characters are my characters. And even as I'm talking about this now, the whole thing sounds so stupid to talk about your dumb book and, you know, like, well, how are you going to use the World Trade Center or not? You know, but, it, you know, if they're going to come out of my consciousness, then I guess I'm going to use it.
So when you sit down to write, I guess you're actually writing about September 11th now, so perhaps it doesn't, so perhaps it comes easier because of that.
Well, what happens, what's happening with me in terms of writing about it is I'm not writing about the day, and I'm not writing about, you know, people that were in the maelstrom. I'm writing about people on the peripheries. And I've always been more interested in taking a slice off the periphery and, like, you know, assuming it's like DNA, it's going to replicate and represent the whole at some point. So I'm more concerned about what it's like for, say, like a shy 15-year-old kid who's been commandeered by his police officer mother into walking the two Puerto Rican kids who just moved into the neighborhood who are little, and everybody assumes they're Arabic because of their looks, and these kids need bodyguards to get to school and back. And this kid doesn't want to do it because he's scared, and his mother's making him because she's a cop and she's fed up with this kid, you know, being a chicken. And how this, over the course of the week, how this kid sort of grows into the role of what is it? And these kids aren't even Arabic. I mean, but I mean, that's where I would go with something like this.
How honest are you with your children about the news and about your own actual fears?
Okay, well see, this is important because this goes back to what I'm saying. There are some kids that, you know, are very on top of it, and some kids that are, you know, it's just, you know, they're not at the age yet, you know, where they're reading newspapers. To my youngest daughter, I feel like, you know, she knows what's going on. Just tell her no subways. She never takes a subway anyhow. Just tell her, and that stupid phrase, common sense, comes up. There's really not much to tell her. I don't want to make her any more anxious than she would normally be. I mean, we live and we're living. My other daughter was very, very alert to what's going on. In fact, her school has been evacuated four times for bomb threats since September 11th. And she told me that she doesn't feel like she's a kid anymore. She said that there are adults, and the adults are those who know what's going on, and everybody else is children. And she feels, at the age of 16, that she knows as much as we do, but she also realizes, and this is what's the scary and depressing thing, that because she knows as much as we do, she cannot come to us for the traditional comfort. Our role thing happens. She knows as much about anthrax as we do. So it's not, she can't come to her mom and dad and, you know, and say, you know, put me to bed and tell me not to worry. Because, you know, we don't have any secret information, or we don't have any secret strength. And this has forced her to feel like she's become an adult under protest. I mean, sort of an adult without adult experience. And she kind of is in a kind of a state of grieving for, you know, having blown off a good part of what it means to be a teenager. My only hope is that it's temporary and she's wrong. But, you know, it has to be acknowledged what she said, because I think it rings a bell with a lot of kids her age.
Richard Price, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Novelist and screenwriter Richard Price, his latest novel is Freedom Land. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Thallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with CNN's terrorism analyst Peter Bergen. His new book, Holy War, Inc., is a biography of bin Laden, and a description of his global network. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.